thought this evening I would bring up the material that I sent out on the Responding Gate email newsletter, with maybe just a little more detail and some time for discussion. I thought tonight we might do our small group discussion format to try to, you know, feel our way into what this material might actually mean, you know, for each of us. There's a way that when we read and think about things, you know, we're considering them in a certain way, but when we really sort of speak to them with somebody listening, there's a way that that material can be sort of incorporated or looked at in a little different way. So hopefully this won't be boring if you carefully read every word of that big long email and carefully studied it, but you know, I can't imagine very many of you did, so. This is a great trick of the trade that I learned from Norman, which hopefully I remember to access, which is like, it's okay to repeat yourself, you know. It's actually probably really helpful, you know. And then you don't have to work so hard. It's really good, you know. Good for everybody. We're cursed in our culture with the great burden of needing to be original all the time, right? Not only you can't copy somebody else, and you certainly can't repeat yourself, you know. How boring that is. So this is mostly just what was in the email with a few extra remarks, and then we'll discuss. So I've been thinking about that maybe an important part of our work, you know, and you could say work on the cushion or work in the practice or just work, you know, of being a human being. You know, maybe a central part of that work that we don't always think about might be the work of just letting ourselves be seen, letting ourselves be seen. And of course, people do see us in a way, and they see some physicality. We have a very complicated and subtle system of reading expressions in the body and in the face. We see each other from the way that we speak and the ways that we move, the ways that we act, the jobs that we take. And so in a way, of course, people do see us. But it also seems like a deep part of our challenge, a deep part of our challenge as a human being is that there's a certain way that we hide, too. And that we learned how to hide as a young child and have been hiding ever since. A certain way that there's a desire born out of something to obscure, to maybe act in a certain way that we think we're supposed to act, to put on a certain kind of a front for the world. And maybe this sort of creation of a persona, you know, is sort of in large part a sort of a hiding that we do. And you know, hiding is bad too, right? So, you know, letting all hang out is good, hiding is bad, but I think that's not quite it either. There's a certain way that we create a self and are always creating and recreating a self. Maybe you could say selfing. Maybe we're selfing all the time. And so how do we do that in a way that's helpful and connecting instead of isolating and removing? And I came up with a great little phrase writing this email that, you know, maybe the forces I wrote here, through all the forces at work within us, a kind of I don't even know how to pronounce this word. It's a good word. Simulacrum of a person emerges. We hold that between us and the world as a kind of like a human shield. You know, our human shield is us. You know. And there's a lot of evidence for this being the case if you look carefully at the body and really notice the sensations in the body, and in particular to notice the sensations in the face. And the tensions in the face, because the face is like our social interface, right? And there are different psychological disorders where people can't interpret facial expressions. And so we know that it's a vast amount of information is communicated between us just through the ways that we hold our face. And so now just take a moment and just notice, and even better if we lie down maybe, but how does the face actually feel? You know, is the jaw relaxed, or is it sort of held rigidly in some way? Are the cheeks held in a certain way, or are they relaxed? You know, is there a certain sort of expression that we're holding? And what would it be just to really let the face relax? And what would that bring up for us? So are we letting ourselves really be seen the way we actually are? And, you know, it seems kind of obvious to us that to the extent that we're hiding, there's a kind of a blockage there, right? There's a kind of a way that intimacy is reduced and true intimacy and connection with others is prevented, because how can anyone be really intimate with us and really connected with us if they can't actually see who we really are? Do we want them to be intimate with some other version of us that we're sort of holding out to one side or in front of us? And if people can't really see us, not only is there a loss of intimacy, maybe also people can't help us. They can't really support us. And they can't really even sort of be with us in a certain way. We're sending a sort of mixed message. And it really does seem like the root, or a root cause of our sort of existential suffering. The Buddha expressed suffering as having three main categories. And so the first is just like sort of obvious pain, physical pain, emotional pain. Someone hurts you in some obvious way, you feel pain, right? So it's the first category. Call that dukkha-dukkha, like suffering. Dukkha-dukkha, which is a good expression. You can remember that. Oh, dukkha-dukkha! And then the second kind of suffering, or dukkha, he talked about was suffering due to change. Dukkha viparinama or something like that. And that's interesting. He gave change a whole category. Right, so that's worth looking at. That could be a whole other talk or series of talks, or you could write that talk. What is the suffering due to change? And he doesn't just mean like everything's going along fine and there's no change. And then there's a change and you don't like that and then there's suffering. He's talking more like moment by moment. Everything is changing. And there's a certain kind of trouble for us because we are in a kind of resistant relationship to that change. He's not saying that change is sort of inherently bad, but that there's something about our relationship to change that causes suffering, and that this is quite universal. But then the third category of dukkha is a dukkha samskara, and samskara is just like the way the mind cognizes reality. There's sort of a suffering from just sort of the way we understand existence, even on the best of days, this is that sort of little niggly sense in the background, on the best of days, or right after you got really good news, you know, the sense that, you know what I mean? Something's not quite what I want, not quite something, not quite right. And so it seems like a great sort of underlying cause of these levels of sort of suffering and harmony, disease, even when there's happiness, there's a little bit of disharmony, right? Is separation. That we feel separated. We feel isolated. And as we practice, and we notice this sense of isolation and separation from others, and sometimes even a sense of separation from people very close to us, and that's a certain kind of trouble. But then I think as we practice, we also notice that there's a kind of a separation from ourself, which is a little more subtle, a little more hard to understand. English language, I think, doesn't, and even psychology language doesn't really, it's hard to sort of put a finger on this. The sense of a sort of internal divide, and maybe we feel this just from the sort of the results of it, a sense of sort of agitation or something, or disease, not being able to settle on ourself. Apparently Katagiri Roshi used to say that to practice Zazen is to settle the self on the self. To settle the self on the self. And then he would usually say, and let the life flower bloom. the sort of funny Japanese accent, which I won't attempt to do. And so this hiding, and we certainly have seen this, I think, in our lives, or sometimes you notice something about yourself that you hadn't noticed because you somehow had not been seeing, sort of hiding it from yourself. And you know, and as we watch the sort of voices and feelings and ideas and sensations that come and go, we also notice that there's also kind of a voice longing, a voice kind of longing for connection, for healing, for being seen, for everything to be revealed, and in other voices that are afraid of that or resistant to that or something, or blocking that. So I was trying to think about, well, how can we really work with this and not just have it be yet another thing that's wrong with us? Like, oh, great, you know. One more reason why we're screwed up, you know. What a great religion. You know, what would be a way that we could work with this sense, this sort of sense of being hidden, being obscured, that would actually be helpful? And how could we work with that not only in ourselves, but also in our relationships with others? This feeling maybe that there's a wound within us that's just sort of too big. And maybe it's possible to let it be seen. And so I was reflecting that it's always wise for us, and we've seen this again and again in our lives and in our practice and our study, to return to our main tools, the reliable tools in our toolbox, do not seem to be like how smart we are or how skilled we are or trying to be a good person. But it seems like the reliable tools in our toolbox for this kind of work are awareness and attention. And if people can't really see us, not only is there a loss of intimacy, maybe also people can't help us. They can't really support us. And they can't really even sort of be with us in a certain way. We're sending a sort of mixed message. And it really does seem like the root, or a root, cause of our sort of existential suffering. The Buddha expressed suffering as having three main categories. And so the first is just like sort of obvious pain, physical pain, emotional pain. Someone hurts you in some obvious way, you feel pain, right? So it's the first category. Called that dukkha-dukkha, like suffering. Dukkha-dukkha, which is a good expression. Can you remember that? Oh, dukkha-dukkha! And then the second kind of suffering, or dukkha, he talked about was suffering due to change. Suffering due to change. Dukkha-viparinama, or something like that. And that's interesting. He gave change a whole category, right? So that's worth looking at. That could be a whole other talk or series of talks, or you could write that talk. What does the suffering do to change? And he doesn't just mean like everything's going along fine and there's no change, and then there's a change and you don't like that, and then there's suffering. He's talking more like moment by moment, everything is changing. And there's a certain kind of trouble for us because we are in a kind of resistant relationship to that change. He's not saying that change is sort of inherently bad, but that there's something about our relationship to change that causes suffering, and that this is quite universal. But then the third category of dukkha is dukkha samskara, and samskara is just like the way the mind cognizes reality. There's sort of a suffering from just sort of the way we understand existence, even on the best of days, this is that sort of little niggly sense in the background, on the best of days, or right after you got really good news, you know, this sense that, you know what I mean? Something's not quite what I want, not quite something, not quite right. And so it seems like a great sort of underlying cause of this these levels of sort of suffering and disharmony, disease, even when there's happiness, there's a little bit of disharmony, right? Is separation, that we feel separated, we feel isolated. And as I think as we practice, and we notice this sense of isolation and separation from others, and sometimes even a sense of separation from people very close to us, and that's a certain kind of trouble. But then I think as we practice, we also notice that there's a kind of a separation from ourself, which is a little more subtle, a little more hard to understand. English language, I think, doesn't, and even psychology language doesn't really, it's hard to sort of put a hand, a foot, a finger on this. The sense of a sort of internal divide, a sort of, and maybe we feel this just from the sort of the results of it, a sense of sort of agitation or something, or disease, not being able to settle on ourselves. Apparently, Katagiri Roshi used to say that to practice Zazen is to settle the self on the self. To settle the self on the self. And then he would usually say, and let the life flower bloom. This sort of funny Japanese accent, which I won't attempt to do. And so, this hiding, and we certainly have seen this, I think, in our lives, or sometimes you notice something about yourself that you hadn't noticed because you somehow had not been seeing, sort of hiding it from yourself. And you know, and as we watch the sort of voices and feelings and ideas and sensations that come and go, I think we also notice that there's also kind of a voice longing, a voice kind of longing for connection, for healing, for being seen, for everything to be revealed, and in other voices that are afraid of that or resistant to that or something, or blocking that. So I was trying to think about, well, how can we really work with this and not just have it be yet another thing that's wrong with us? Like, oh, great, you know. One more reason why we're screwed up, you know. What a great religion. And what would be a way that we could work with this sense, this sort of sense of being hidden, being obscured, that would actually be helpful? And how could we work with that not only in ourselves, but also in our relationships with others? This feeling maybe that there's a wound within us that's just sort of too big. Maybe it's possible to let it be seen. And so I was reflecting that it's always wise for us, and we've seen this again and again in our lives and in our practice and our study, to return to our main tools, the reliable tools in our toolbox, do not seem to be like how smart we are or how skilled we are or trying to be a good person. It seems like the reliable tools in our toolbox for this kind of work are awareness and attention. Awareness and attention. And we can start there, we can return to there, just breath after breath, moment by moment. It's a present moment work. And there's so much, you know, in the mind and the world that the mind creates that we really don't have much control over. But it seems like with some training and some patience, we actually do have a lot of influence over how we attend to things. So this is pretty important. We have with training and some patience, we can work with our attention in a certain way. And it actually does become possible to attend to things in a different way than we used to. And as we practice attention and attending to things in the present moment, there's awareness that arises, sort of naturally, not something that we force, not something that we make to happen. So I really think awareness is kind of an amazing thing, because something can be right in front of us, and you can see this, you know, with the regular senses too. Something can be right in front of you, and you don't see it. Have you had that experience? And something happens, and you do see it. So this is what they mean in Buddhism by ignorance. Which sounds like a big, heavy, another downer about what's wrong with us, but ignorance actually just means not seeing. Just just means not seeing. And it's not a sort of a judgment of who we are as a person. It's a description of what's happening or not happening. A sort of non-awareness of things as they actually are. So we can really work with this little sort of beam of attention, and we can bring it back to the actual feelings of what's arising now. Right now, the feeling in our heart, in our gut, the flow of emotions and thoughts, the experience of this moment of living. And so this, in a way, is our sort of most precious thing, is how do we attend to this moment? We really kind of don't have anything. So we can't hold on to possessions or money or relationships, you know, it's all going to let us down in the end. But as long as we're alive, it seems like we do have some influence over what we attend to, what we're aware of. And I was thinking that the phrase in English, lost in thought, is really a powerful phrase. It's funny about language, right? We have a lot of wisdom and a lot of miswisdom embedded in our language, you know, so it's worth noting when we got it right, you know, like, yes, lost in thought. You know, when we're lost in thought, we are really lost. We are not here. We're somewhere else, and we're missing part of our life. And maybe if, you know, attention is one of our few sort of precious things. The other thing that's precious is time. And when we're lost in thought, we're throwing away our time. So I'm thinking that working with attention systematically, moment by moment, day by day, is a big part of the answer of how to let ourselves be seen, which definitely involves setting aside time for formal practice, where we don't have so much distraction, so much going on, to really ground ourselves in some meditation technique that we learn from our teacher or our tradition, really work with that. But it also involves a sort of a big aspiration every moment of the day to come back, to come back, to come back. And then we can notice the many ways that our sort of divided self makes that hard, right? The judgments, right? The inner critic. Oh, another thing that I'm not good at. So it's not actually about that. It's actually just about returning. And so getting into the mindfulness work lately, I've become a bit of a science wonk about meditation, which is really like helpful, you know, because I'm doing these mindfulness classes for doctors, and so it's been helpful to trot out science, you know, like, see? I mean, they're already kind of convinced it'd be good for them to practice, but you know, they're so busy and stuff, so if I can get the weight of science behind it, it helps. And I think it helps us in the same way. Because I think another big piece of all this is to acknowledge that on some level, we really think we're sort of fixed, sort of stuck. And so it's helpful to have, like, scientists with their fancy tools saying, no, look, it changes. You're changing. So there are two studies in the last, one was just this last year, it was just published this year, and one was, I think, 2 years ago that are really relevant here. So I want to tell you a little about these two studies. And when your friends are doubting about meditation, you can bring these up too. The first is a really simple, elegantly simple study. And this is by two psychologists at Harvard named Daniel Gilbert and some other guy. Give them credit for doing such a beautiful, simple study. And Matthew Killingsworth. And Daniel Gilbert has written some nice popular press books about happiness that are worth reading too. So what they did is they got quite a large number of people, and they gave them all an iPhone, or maybe an app if they already had an iPhone. And so they got 2,500 people to agree to be part of the study. And what the little app does, you have to carry around your iPhone all day and on your nightstand at night. And what it does is it interrupts you at random times and it asks you three questions. three questions it asks you are, what are you doing? It gives you a bunch of categories of activity. How happy are you? And are you paying attention? Were you paying attention to what you were doing? So what are you doing? How happy are you? And were you paying attention? And they collected about 250,000 of these responses. It's like a quite a large data set. And what they found was, and so they were interested in, you know, how do these three things influence each other? We tend to think that doing something we like makes us happy, right? That's sort of axiomatic to Western culture. You know, do the things you like, you know. That's the American dream, to do what I want all the time, and I'll be really happy. And we all believe that to some extent. So they were curious, what's the connection between doing what you want, how happy you are, and whether you're paying attention to what you're doing? And the two things they found that are really important for us are, one is they found that am I paying attention to what I'm doing or not? 50%. So half the time, the people in their study, their minds were wandering, they're thinking about something else. They were worrying about the future or the past, and they didn't really collect data on what they were thinking about, but they weren't attending what they're doing. So about half the time, our fellow Americans are lost in thought. And the second thing they found that's really important is doing a desirable thing makes you a little bit happier. And it was a very, I don't know if you know statistics, but it was a very weak correlation. I can give you a copy of their data. I printed out the cool little bubble chart, which I made a few copies I can show you later. But on this little bubble chart, on the left is more happy, and the size of the bubble is how often it was happening. So there's one way off on the left, which is making love. People were pretty happy. I guess a little thing went off, you know. And you had to excuse me, honey. Huh? So it might make you think that, oh, well, that's a really happy-making thing. But actually, it doesn't really pan out. It's just, what the much better correlation was not a desirable thing. The much better correlation was, were you paying attention to what you're doing? So on average, people are happier doing the dishes and so on, really paying attention to it, than they are the different things are like listening to music, playing, eating. These are things that make you happy. They interrupted a couple of people praying, worshiping, and meditating. It's like the smallest dot on here. So people do that rarely. So that's pretty interesting, that people's minds are wandering about half the time, and a much better predictor of happiness is whether you're paying attention to what you're doing. So, which is not, I mean, it's not to say that it doesn't matter what you're doing. There was a, you know, rough correlation. There's a less good correlation there. You are a little bit happier doing the things that you like to do. But you'd be much happier paying attention to everything you're doing. So that's good. That seems relevant to us as meditation students. Like, this will make us happier. You know, this is good, right? Right? I don't know why you're here, but it'd be nice to be happier. And then the second study, so that's a very simple study. The second study is a very complicated neurology study. And I got a copy of this from my friend who helped on the study. He sent me all these color pictures of brain scans and stuff, and lots of long Latin words for the different areas of the brain, which I didn't try to sort out. But what they found is really important. In the last couple of years, neurologists are starting to identify the areas of the mind that are active when we're just sort of spacing out, when we're ruminating, not really thinking about anything, lost in thought, in other words. Because, if you were to think of the brain as a machine we just use to kind of get things done, you would think that when we weren't doing anything, it would just sort of turn off, right? Or be on a really low idle. But it turns out, neurology studies, now that they can watch the brain in real time with their functional MRI machines, which they love, you know, it turns out the brain is in a really high idle all the time. You know, it's like somebody needs, I guess cars don't have carburetors anymore, but someone needs to adjust the carburetor or the fuel injection because it's racing all the time, you know. It's like you've got the pedal halfway down all the time, you know, and no wonder it's kind of jarring when you actually do anything because you're kidding, you know, you're jamming the car in gear while the motor's running fast. And so as they started to identify the parts of the brain that are active when that's happening, they're sort of on the sides of the brain. And the other part, they're starting to identify other parts of the brain that are more active when people are grounded, centered, you know, aware of present moment phenomena, more, like there's lots of different studies, like more empathetic, more compassionate, more connected, you know, which tend to be different areas, but the big one seems to be the left prefrontal cortex, kind of back in here. And so what this study looked at was, they looked at experienced meditators and beginning meditators, and they're curious to know if this default mode network, they call it, it's not just one area, it's a network of areas, which makes sense. So the self, so this is the self, you know, this personality. The self seems to be a network of areas in the brain that are constantly sort of exchanging information on this sort of high to high idle. So what they found was experienced meditators, their default mode network is much less active during meditation than the beginning meditators. And the experienced meditators reported less spacing out, less. And what the little app does, you have to carry around your iPhone all day and on your nightstand at night. And what it does is it interrupts you at random times and it asks you three questions. The three questions it asks you are, what are you doing? And it gives you a bunch of categories of activity. How happy are you? And are you paying attention? Were you paying attention to what you were doing? So what are you doing? How happy are you? And were you paying attention? And they collected about a quarter million of these responses. It's like quite a large data set. And what they found was, and so they were interested in, you know, how do these three things influence each other? We tend to think that doing something we like makes us happy, right? That's sort of axiomatic to Western culture. You know, do the things you like, you know. That's the American dream, to do what I want all the time, and I'll be really happy. And we all believe that to some extent. So they were curious, what's the connection between doing what you want, how happy you are, and whether you're paying attention to what you're doing? And the two things they found that are really important for us are, one is they found that am I paying attention to what I'm doing or not? 50%. So half the time, the people in their study, their minds were wandering or thinking about something else. They were worrying about the future or the past, and they didn't really collect data on what they were thinking about, but they weren't attending what they're doing. So about half the time, our fellow Americans are lost in thought. And the second thing they found that's really important is doing a desirable thing makes you a little bit happier. And it was a very, I don't know if you know statistics, but it was a very weak correlation. I can give you a copy of their data. I printed out that they have a cool little bubble chart, which I kind of made a few copies I can show you later. But on this little bubble chart, on the left is more happy. And the size of the bubble is how often it was happening. So there's one way off on the left, which is making love. People were pretty happy. I guess the little thing went off, you know. And you had to excuse me, honey.
Huh?
So it makes you think that, oh, well, that's a really happy-making thing. But actually, it doesn't really pan out. It's just, the much better correlation was not a desirable thing. The much better correlation was, were you paying attention to what you're doing? So on average, people are happier doing the dishes and so on, really paying attention to it, than they are the different things are like listening to music, playing, eating. These are things that make you happy. They interrupted a couple of people praying, worshiping, and meditating. It's like the smallest dot on here. So people do that rarely. So that's pretty interesting, that people's minds are wandering about half the time. And a much better predictor of happiness is whether you're paying attention to what you're doing.